We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here looking in the mirror.
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee. Split Zone Duo. Thank you to all of our subscribers on Substack, splitzoneduo.com. This is a podcast that I've been excited to do for quite some time. And I'm glad to get him on. Eric Galco, the director of the East-West Shrine Bowl. The man who I think we can say has changed the sport of football at least once, possibly twice.
Yeah, we'll take it. Sure. Yeah.
We will get to the football that you will see on Sundays and maybe Saturdays in the future. And the kickoff and all that sort of stuff in a little bit, but it's draft season. And that is the bread and butter for Eric. It is why we are often on the phone for hours at a time, kicking around this prospect or that prospect. Eric, your laundry list of kind of accomplishments on the personnel side of football are myriad. Can you just kind of take the folks through your journey to where you are right now running the East-West Shrine Bowl?
Yeah, it's been a lot of unique things. I've kind of made my bread and butter in doing things outside the kind of traditional path of working in football. But a lot of my work has been in consulting, working with startup football leagues, smaller all-star games, and then about 6 years ago now. I got hired about 6 years ago today, to be honest, got hired by the XFL to be their league's director of player personnel and work with Oliver Luck and Doug Whaley and Sam Schwartzstein, a friend of yours I know as well, in helping build the XFL back in 2018 until COVID unfortunately ended the league. And a year after that, I took over for the East-West Shrine Bowl, the longest standing college all-star game, and kind of building that back to where it was, 15, 20 years ago as well as a premier event in the offseason too. So I've taken a lot of pride in being a part of organizations that like to build, like to be innovative. And I've thankfully been a lot of cool people along the way that I got a chance to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see football and why it's always to me just so instructive when we talk is just because of the way you see the sport is outside, right? You don't work for a team. You don't have a team interest.
Yeah.
And so your vantage point on the sport is always fascinating when we get on the horn and talk. Let me let you get it out of the way. Give me your 2024 NFL draft hot take or takes, plural, because Lord knows you got them. Give the ones that are fit for purpose and fit for public consumption that aren't going to get you fired.
Oh, it's a good one. I think Brian Thomas and A.D. Mitchell, I think those are two receivers that I'd be surprised if one of those two guys, I'd be surprised if one of those two guys didn't end up being better than Roma Dunze, Marvin Harrison, and Malik Nabers. I don't know which one. I'm not saying I'd rank them above them right now, but I think those two guys are uniquely gifted that I think in any other year would be slam dunk top 10 picks. And this year they're thought of as receiver 4 or 5. That's the first one. Again, I'm not saying I rank them above them, but I'm saying if I was a betting man, one of those two guys will outperform one of the top three guys.
LSU's Brian Thomas, who was not wide receiver one on his own football team, by the way. That belonged to Malik Nabers. And then A.D. Mitchell. I think the A.D. thing is clear. The guy runs a 4.1, whatever the hell it was at the combine. But show your work for me on Brian Thomas as someone who roots for the Jacksonville Jaguars and is a receiver needy team. Maybe at 17, maybe if they trade up, who knows?
Yeah, well, he won't be there at 17. That I could put in ink for you. He will not be there at 17, Brian Thomas. I think he won't go to the top 14, 15 picks. And I think a big reason why is, number one, he's 6'2 plus. He runs a low 4.3. I mean, that alone was like, are you kidding me? I think if you're at LSU practices, it's really easy for people, especially looking at the draft context, right? Because everyone who covers it for the draft, besides some people, are starting with the list. Hey, this is a ranking. I'm making my own ranking. I think it's really hard for Brian Thomas to be like, hey, Nabers is better and Brian Thomas is too, and I got to rank him that way. And I think if you just showed up at LSU practice 10 days in a row and didn't have a depth chart, I think it'd be closer to 5 and 5 that Brian Thomas had a better than Malik Nabers, right? I think Nabers is a better prospect. Let me be clear. But my point is that there isn't this huge delta. I think in the media sometimes, and even the NFL too, you get so locked into your rankings that it's so hard to change or even think critically for something. Brian Thomas is a freak. He is incredibly talented. He is still scratching the surface of his ability. You know, he's, I think, 195, 199. People at LSU tell me, like, he plays like he's 215, 220. He just has this, like, Lane Johnson thing where, like, he's so strong in his lower body, but his weight doesn't look like it sometimes. And, like, he's this really rare physical specimen, probably more unique than any other receiver in this whole class. in terms of not many people are built like this and can move like this. And that's why I think Brian Thomas, again, maybe he ends up being, you know, a guy that ends up never maximizing his ceiling, but man, talent wise and the right, if he goes to the Jaguars where he can be receiver two for a minute, or he goes to the Bills and is their wide receiver one, like, this guy is, again, could be one of the best receivers in football in 3-4 years if he hits the ceiling. That's how talented Brian Thomas is.
All right. Draft hot take number two. Give me the draft hot take that I know you have about the defensive tackles.
Yeah. Well, Byron Murphy, yes. Is that what you're getting at? That's what you're leading me to. I think Byron Murphy, similar to like a Brian Thomas almost, would I think most years be a clear top five, top six pick in the draft. And I think he is in contention, if not the best defensive player in this draft.
Byron Murphy, Texas defensive tackle.
Yeah, he is. I think his conservative comparison is Grady Jarrett. And I think if you showed up at Texas practice like I did, it was I joke, some guys are 10 play guys. He was a one drill guy where I'm like, this is a waste of my time. This guy's legs are tree trunks. It's incredible the way he moves, the way he bends. I was told at Texas that day standing next to their staff. Right. So, I mean, Byron Murphy is not maybe the freak athlete testing wise that Aaron Donald was. Didn't produce a lot of the same way, with a little bit different scheme and opportunities. And again, I don't think he's as good as Aaron Donald is, but I think he could be 90%. And if you told me I can get 90% Aaron Donald, I would take that guy in the top 10, top five every single day. And I think that's why he's a guy that I'm like, people aren't putting in the top 10 yet, but if the Falcons took him at 8, I'd be like, that makes sense, right? If other teams just said, screw it, we need a guy. If the Seahawks traded up, if the Rams traded up to replace Aaron Donald with him as well, I'd be like, yep, I could see that. So I think he, Jared Verse, and Olu Fashanu are the three guys that might not go top 10 that I think by week 8, we could be like, are you kidding me? These guys are going to go top 10. Like, these guys would have been first 3 picks, 4 picks in the draft in most other draft classes the last 5-6 years. But it's because we have the 4 great quarterbacks going top 4 picks overall, probably. We've got 3 awesome receivers, and we've got a dearth of offensive tackles and teams that are planning on drafting offensive tackles so early that couple of those guys might fall to the teens, even Vera Verse, maybe late or early 20s, which is crazy. So that's my other hot take too.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. 4 quarterbacks, by the way, if you're listening to this, real SZD heads will know the QB preview special with friends of the program, Ben Solak and Derek Klassen, is still coming before the draft. We will be doing that, but I think you just previewed your QB preview special. 4 quarterbacks in the first 4 picks. Does that have something to do with the Arizona Cardinals moving out to take one of them? What are we talking about here? And give me your order.
Spicy. Yeah.
If you sit here and tell me Jaden Daniels is better than Drake May, I'm going to kick you off the show.
My personal ranking of these quarterbacks, I think there's a clear, I think that the top 4 guys are the right 4 guys. I won't be here and saying other guys are great too. I think there's stuff that Penix does, Nix does, Rattler does, that I think are intriguing, but I think the top 4 guys are the best 4 quarterbacks. I think all 4 of these guys, I can make an argument, would be a first overall pick in some years, right? In a weaker year, right? Caleb, I think, is really exciting, really intriguing. The Aaron Rodgers comps get me excited. I got a chance to talk with Caleb this summer for a little bit, and he's just wise beyond his years. Like, he's able to kind of command respect pretty quickly, not because of the talent, but because of who he is, the person. He's extremely self-confident, which I think is a really important trait in quarterbacks these days. I truly think Jaden and Drake May are very different. And there's something that Jaden does that I'm like, that's not going to work, right? I think there's something that Drake does that I'm like, man, like, this guy is just, is he the next Blake Bortles, right? Oh, and I think that's the negative on those two guys. I think if I had the draft and then I was going to hire my coach in that order, I would take Drake May. And I think that's not how the draft works, not how teams are built. I think Drake May is that talented. But I've got a chance to know Jaden. Like, he has shown the ability to get better in ways that very few quarterbacks have ever shown in the draft process, right? Like, he was this player. This offseason, he made strides that he's shown NFL teams, I am still getting better, right? He is not a ball of clay that says, like, if I work with this guy, I can make him better. He has worked with LSU on advanced vision training, right? He has worked mental and cognitive stuff with their staff. He has worked with John Beck and Taylor Kelly religiously all offseason. Like, and then it worked on the field too. I think sometimes we talk about upside and development, and that's exciting. But I kind of want to see that a guy's still getting better before I think he's going to get better. And Jaden has. So I think for Jaden and Drake, I think Jaden goes too. But I think Jaden and Drake is really in the right situation, those guys can be awesome. That sounds like a cliche thing to say. but I think they're very different players and very different schemes. And then JJ McCarthy is, I think, a more athletic version of Kirk Cousins. And I think that's pretty, I would feel safe with JJ McCarthy.
That is the most fair, clear-eyed JJ McCarthy analysis that I think I've heard this entire process. That is, that's it. And you can win with that. You can win with that in this league. There's no question about it. So good. Somebody's coming up to four to take JJ McCarthy. How do you see this going?
Yeah, I think the four quarterbacks will go 1, 2, 3, 4. There's some, if the Patriots trade out of the third pick, that creates, I think, a 1, 2, 3, 4 situation. If they stay, I think there's a couple different, I think all four quarterbacks are definitely going in the top 7, 8 picks, probably top 7. But I think they go 1, 2, 3, 4 just because I think teams need them. And the Giants are there at 6. And, you know, one of the fun wrinkles, right, is that if the Broncos are going to move up for a quarterback, well, they can't go to 5 because the Chargers are there, right? And, like, Jim Harbaugh's not trading his, you know, extra child and JJ McCarthy to his division rival, right? So, like, so the Broncos go to 4 to get him or wait till 7. But I think those four guys go that early. I think one of the interesting parts to me is there's 5, maybe 6 teams that have devise their offseason to tell you that they're probably looking at quarterbacks in the top 3 rounds of the draft, right? There's the Bears, the Commanders, Patriots, Vikings, Broncos, and then maybe the Raiders, although I just have a hard time thinking they're going to make either Gardner Minshew or Aiden O'Connell a third string quarterback, right? And taking a guy in the top 2 rounds, you're basically doing that. So I think there's really 5 teams, and there's more than 5 quarterbacks that I think a lot of people outside think might go in the top 100 picks. So we're kind of a little bit supply and demand question where don't be surprised if a guy that people talk about on Twitter think that, hey, this guy might go first round, like he might go late 3rd, early 4th in that Desmond Ridder, Malik Willis tier. So I think the vacuum of teams that need quarterbacks versus how many people think are going to go in the top 3 rounds is probably a little bit different.
This scouting background that you have evaluating, you know, you're not just a quarterback guy, you evaluate, you know, down the whole roster, obviously. How did you develop that? Because folks that don't know, you know, Eric's a lawyer, that's your background. You know, you're not a guy who played in the league 10 years or what have you. How did you develop this skill set to evaluate across positions and across teams?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I kind of give advice to people that are starting out as well, too, is to be really critically, creatively developing yourself as a scout, right? It's not about just posting a scout report on Twitter and saying it's good or saying, oh, I missed that guy or that team was dumb, they didn't take my guy either. And I've always been really proactive in talking with former executives, people like Ted Sundquist way back when, and coaches that I got a chance to work with, people like Mike Sherman. I work at a league called York Hall Football and kind of glam him a little bit too. And I think for me, I had the benefit of, at a really early age in this business, of consulting. And why that was beneficial was that I was paid to be right. Hmm. And if you're wrong, you lose that, right? You aren't paid, right? So it put a lot of pressure on me to get better quickly and to not make mistakes and be really thoughtful. And I think a lot of times people on the outside that want to get into this business just will watch film, write a report, and call it a day. And for me, it's like, hey, if you don't feel that pressure of being wrong, you're not going to really get better. And I had that benefit a lot early on too. So I've had some great mentors, but I think for me, what worked for me was that, like, I just couldn't F up, right? If I F'd up, I was going to be out of work, and I didn't want to do that. And again, I didn't have a family member in the league. I didn't play at a high level. I had to earn everything I had to do. And I think that pressure really helped help me do better. And then I think the XFL was, and the Shrine Bowl to some extent too, has really helped me develop, because in the XFL, you know, one thing I talked to Oliver Luck and Sam Schwartz, and one of the reasons I think they brought me on was I had a good sense of what our teams are going to look like. Hey, our offensive line play is not going to be good, and we got to find a quarterback that's going to make that work. And my pitch to them was that the answer is not experience necessarily. The answer is not athleticism necessarily. It's a skill that I think is extremely valuable nowadays in the NFL is improvisation. Hmm. Which you can have if you're Tom Brady in the A-gap, you can have if you're Lamar Jackson outside the box, right? But guys that when the play breaks down or the play is not scripted as designed or doesn't go as designed, can that guy still adjust and make a play under control? And I think it might, that's a common thread between Pat Mahomes to PJ Walker, who's a guy I wanted when I got hired in the XFL, to Brock Purdy, who we had in the Shrine Bowl. Like, that's their common thread of some level of success in football. I think that's why quarterbacks, I thankfully had some decent success, whether it's the Shrine Bowl or whether it's something else too. But I think that's where my scouting philosophy has been, is trying to attack a problem and have that pressure of being right. And thankfully, from the XFL to the Shrine Bowl, having an increase in draft picks every single year I've been here, Hopefully it goes to show that a little bit too.
You talked about starting the XFL when you guys did and knowing these offensive linemen are not going to be able to play. We at least pass blocking wise, we talk about it globally, the dearth of offensive linemen in the NFL and how good offensive lines are. That is a common criticism. What is it, especially at that position, what is it you've seen in your 10 plus years of doing this at all different levels? Like, is offensive line development, is it getting bad, worse? Is it getting better? Is it just have offensive lines pretty much always been mid? Like, what is it? And I know some of it has to do with the defensive ends just becoming absolute freaks over the last 10 or 15 years, really and truly. But where are you at on the development of offensive line writ large kind of in the sport right now?
It's a great question. I think I've gathered my current opinion on offensive line play from my own experience, as well as Duke Manyweather, who I think said this to me a while back as well. And I think one of the problems is first off, like, defensive linemen are unbelievable athletes, and offensive linemen and corners are in such a tough position to be successful, because you're reacting, and the faster the receiver or edge rusher's reaction time is, the quicker yours has to be, which is asking an impossible question. But I think for offensive linemen, people are still evaluating offensive linemen and corners. Our mutual friend Justice Mosqueda kind of invented the idea in my mind, creators and preventers, right? And preventers are offensive linemen and corners, right? 45 good. If you play 50 snaps in a game as an offensive lineman and 45 are awesome and 5 are bad and you give up 5 sacks, you're out of a job, right? Same thing for corner. And I think still too often people are watching offensive linemen for the upside plays and the exciting athleticism plays that we look for as defensive ends or receivers. That's not really the job, right? Like, I you can watch David Bakhtiari at Colorado and early at Green Bay. It doesn't really look that sexy, but he just wins reps. And I think that's where Duke Manyweather told me that in the XFL in year two of the XFL, when I was there in 2020 going to 2021, we were going to bring on Duke. And I asked him, like, hey, how do we make our offensive linemen better? And he's like, don't bring on basketball players or 21-year-old guys. Hmm. Give me a guy who has played and has experience, and I can make him 10% better versus starting from scratch and making a guy a lot better. And that's, I think, the approach. I think teams that make mistakes in scouting offensive linemen are tools and traits. And tools and traits are great if you can be Tyron Smith, be toolsy and traitsy and really good. That's ideal, right? But I think, you know, I'd rather just have an undersized guard Randy Mueller in the XFL, Houston Roughnecks. They were a 5-0 team when I was there, and he was a great GM, and his guard was like 5'11", but the dude was an efficient mover, effective, and they won games that way. I think that's where NFL teams that have had success, the Cowboys done a great job too, looking for traits, but also like, hey, this guy started a lot of games. He knows what he's doing. We can make him 10% better and he can start for us. That's okay. I think, long story short, I think offensive line play needs to be more about winning reps than looking good doing it. I think teams will be a lot more successful drafting these guys.
You talked a little bit about, you know, Jaden Daniels' development, some of the vision work that he's done and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Overall, how do you find, let's do this question in two parts, but I, with the top end of the draft, with the best players in the draft, how is it that you see them being developed or not at the college level, at their, especially at the elite college teams? And then how do you see that translate to the NFL, you know, early on in their careers?
I think we're getting there from an NIL standpoint of teams realizing that it can't just be, we get a bucket of money, let's pay these guys, and now they're here and we're good, right? I think teams some teams did a great job at originally, but some teams now are looking for outside position coaches or more resource players to get better while they're there, which I think is a good use for money. But for a long time, colleges were not setting guys up for success. You know, I think one of the cool things, and I won't tell the whole story because it's not my story to tell, but, you know, I talked to Caleb Williams and his dad about transferring from Oklahoma, and they kind of asked people in different schools they were looking at, hey, you know, if I send Caleb Williams to medical school in 4 years, he better be a doctor. If I send him to law school in 3 years, he better be a lawyer. If I send him to your school in 2-3 years, he better be an NFL quarterback. What's your plan? And I think it's a great question that I think a lot of parents maybe should ask these coaches too. I give Carl Williams, who I think gets a bad rap these days, he's an incredibly smart guy and I think has a lot of good interest for his son and mine. But I think that's where colleges are going to start to hopefully get to next. But that's where I go back to, I think right now a lot of players going from college to pro, it's on them to get a lot better, which is probably unfair, but that's why what Jaden did is so impressive, right? He has taken resources that were available to him and made himself better in a big way, right? And there's probably, I asked Jaden you know, before the draft process started. I'm like, what was the thing? And he said like eight things. And I'm like, well, I'd probably, you know, get that down a little bit too. But that just shows that he was doing eight different things, changing his sleep patterns, working with receivers, some of the advanced vision stuff he was doing. Like, I think that's what gets me most excited for a guy like him. And that's where the question we always talk about as our staff is this guy raw or underdeveloped? Raw means there's a reason to think he might still get better. Underdeveloped means he's at every chance to get better and he still hasn't. And why should I think he's going to get better in the NFL? I think college has to probably assess better, are they developing these guys? And if they're still leaving college underdeveloped, is it our fault or was it the player's fault? I think more often not, it's the college's fault. But in the NFL, quarterback is the most obvious one. If you're not a ready guy by 2 years, you're done. I mean, your career's, there's only a couple guys that get two, three chances at it. Sam Darnold, Baker Mayfield, and that's probably the whole list in the NFL right now getting multiple chances. And I think colleges, it's on them a little bit to do a much better job to have these guys prepared when they get there versus prepare for the draft process.
How do you sift through, let's use the word mid. How do you sift through these mid college players who by whatever combination of now it's portal, it's God, the 6 year guys. It's how do you shift or excuse me, sift? How do you sift through how college football is developing players who aren't elite right now for the next level?
Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing that our staff has put a baseline grade on the entire country already for next year, which is before, you know, the NFL has either national or blessed that does these preseason reports for every NFL team. And I mentioned earlier about working off a list. We take a lot of pride in not working off of any preconceived list, right? Our scouts are trained. I call it baseline scouting. Like, you got to be in the ballpark pretty quickly with these guys. We have more time to rank these guys and evaluate later on too. But I think a lot of, again, people on the outside wanting to get in or people in general, it's easier to rank guys when you have a list you're going off of. It's really hard for good scouts to find guys early on and say, hey, I've watched this guy. I don't know anybody else that knows about this guy, but that's it. I think for us, it's using data and information, right? We have access to track and field data, high school combine data, Zebra data for players. That's really helpful to get a sense of what their athleticism may be. We spend a lot of time on background. I tell all of our scouts know this. Like, we have spent as much time on background as we do on scouting reports. And that's because we focus a lot on the objective aspect of scouting, right? Anyone can just talk about hip fluidity and all this nonsense stuff, right? But for us, it's this objective subjective scale. Stats are objective. Background is more objective than subjective. Data, same thing. And if we can put as much data there on the objective side, it allows us to not be wrong. Being right's a different thing, but we're not going to be wrong very often. That allows us to have guys like Mason McCormick, who played the Shrine Bowl this year. He's a guard from South Dakota State. He ended up, you know, getting kind of rejected by the preseason grades, and a lot of area scouts kind of had that bias built in. We knew from July we're going to invite Mason McCormick in our first round of invites, and he ends up playing pretty good for a South Dakota State team. Still not a lot of NFL buzz. We invite him, comes to the Shrine Bowl, crushes it, tests at the highest level possible per RAS. Now he's going to be a second, third, fourth round pick. For us, we're excited about that because, hey, we knew there was kind of player that can play in the NFL. The upside, the talent, that's a different discussion. But I think it's really important for us to have a good baseline of scouting and not rely on other lists to make our own list. That's why I think a lot of people that do this well are really good at that piece of it.
Yeah. So all these experiences that you have, Shrine Bowl comes calling. I remember when you called me and were like, hey, like, I'm taking over the Shrine Bowl and we're going to take it to some different places and all that kind of stuff. Why did the college all-star game call to you essentially? And how has your experience, how have you viewed your experience running that game here the last few years?
It's been awesome, man. I really took a year back to consulting full-time post XFL COVID, which I loved. I'm good at it. I've done it for a while and I enjoy working with a lot of different people too, but really got a chance to meet people at the Shriners Hospital because I was talking with some people about playing football through COVID back in that time period. So I had this weird institutional knowledge, and the Shriners Hospital asked me and found out I was doing that about like, hey, can we play an all-star game during COVID? And they end up not playing that year. But I had a relationship with them too. And I kind of asked them like, hey, I don't want to be high maintenance, but you know, I want to work with this if we're going to be able to do things best in class and have an NFL facility. And I really took the job because I didn't think part of a lot of the draft process was taking care of players in a way that I thought was important and that players deserved. And I also want to use this as a chance to help younger people get hired in the football profession, increase the visibility of data in the profession, and all the other aspects of the football industry that people aren't taking advantage of quite yet either. So I really took it beyond just running an all-star game, but because I think this industry, that part of it is so ripe for innovation. And if we could be a catalyst for it, that'd be great. And I think so far we've changed how other all-star games do things in terms of interviews or player sleep and wellness. Like, I think if I left today, I wouldn't feel it as mission accomplished, but I would feel really proud that the other all-star games and the combine are changing how they're doing things because of the way we've done things. I'm pretty proud of that.
The draft process is fascinating to me because, unlike the high school to college transition or process, yeah, this ain't a beauty contest. You know what I mean? We're not wooing you. We're not bringing you around to show you the locker room or the waterfall in the locker room, for instance. You know, there is a, I mean, the word is dignity. There is a lack of dignity in a lot of different parts of the draft process. You can think about, the weigh-ins where, you know, players are, they look like cattle going through the,
which we got rid of that, by the way. I'm proud of that one too. That's the first thing I took over. I said, we're not doing any more. And thankfully the league office actually made it required for every all-star to get rid of it too. But that was the first thing I thought of too. Like, if I get this job over, we're not doing this freaking way. Yeah. Not having some guy tweet about a bubble butt on Twitter about a player who's interviewing for the NFL. Like, we're not doing this. So I'm sorry to cut you off, but that was a big one. That was the first thing off the checklist for me is like, nope, not doing that one anymore.
And then, you know, the interview stuff you have, like, was it Dez Bryant who, like, they asked him like if his mom was like a prostitute or whatever it was. Like, there are things about the draft process that are just antiquated is the word. Bygone era is the word. How do we modernize? How have you seen it modernized the draft process in the years that you've been doing it to get it to where it is, like you're saying, a professional NFL job interview, because that is what it really is or should be.
I think it's really important that, and I've told people in the NFL, NFL league office, NFL teams, is that, you know, Marvin Harrison this year opting out of testing, right? Other quarterbacks opting out of testing too. 7-8 years ago, it was just Christian McCaffrey not playing in a bowl game, right? And now where we are. About 7-8 years ago, Kristaps Porzingis in the NBA draft didn't give his medicals out, right? And the NBA combine kind of went towards just being second round picks and undrafted guys. And the NBA has fixed that since. I think more and more first round picks, guys like Jalen Williams, Oklahoma State Thunder, played in the NBA combine and did well. And now he's a, you know, star player. But I think the NBA realized after the fact, and we'll have to kind of rehab that a little bit. I hope the NFL was being proactive in making this draft process player included and player in mind, because I worry that people are just saying these darn kids, you know, they don't want to do this stuff, and that's not going to make these guys want to do it. And whether it's the interview process, you know, one thing, the Shrine Bowl, not talking about why we're great or anything, but our interview process is really good, really organized. It's during the day. It's not late at night. That's really important. Our players are able to get rest and recover and interview in a sense that's going to put them in the best position to be successful. Our players are done every night at 8 p.m. I believe in getting 8 to 10 hours of sleep. I think you know this, but people may not know this. Like most all-star games at combine, you're up till 11 o'clock at night doing interviews. And the interviewer and the interviewee is exhausted and probably not being at their best. Cognitive testing has come up this year, right? Should players be doing this as well too? I think all of these ideas, cognitive testing, interviews, they're all valuable for the team and the player to do. But I think, I hope the industry is going to continue to push towards, let's not make it convenient for us, but for the player. I think once we get back to that, the NBA figured that out with the NBA combine and the NBA draft process, and the NFL hope with the same thing too. But, you know, again, I've taken a lot of pride there. I've probably done more than I probably needed to. And some people in the league office are probably mad that I've done those things. But I do hope that in the end, like, by taking care of players, I can leave on that, like, hey, players come to the Shrine Bowl and feel that this part of the process was clean. But I do hope that the entire industry takes it over too, because it is unfair. You know, your question about Dez Bryant, right? And that whole question too, the NFL league office, to their credit, you know, put in a protocol that a player can report anonymously that this question was asked about 5-6 years ago. It happens at the Shrine Bowl this year too, right? A player this year told me about a question a team asked, and that team was notified of that being a problem. So it's gotten better. I think the NFL league office did a good job with that piece too. But I do hope that people appreciate that these players are not only people that deserve to be treated with respect, but also these players, and you see this in the NIL world, man, the last 5-6 years, both because of social media and access to information, as well as these guys are making 50, 60, 70, 100, $1 million a year, they're sophisticated coming in the NFL. They're not naive anymore. They know what their worth is, know what their time is worth. And I get it. I get why they would opt out of things. And I think the NFL needs to make sure that it's worth these players' times to do this, not the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. The that notion of NIL kind of eating away at formerly sixth or seventh rounder UDFA guys or borderline guys, that is something that, you know, the GMs love to complain about, yeah, or whatever. But I know that affects you as someone trying to scout, like, can we get these players who may be edgewise NFL roster guys, because you need those players for your game to boost their own stock. So where are you at on NIL's impact on
that? I love it. I there's agents and players who are like, it's my job to figure that out, right? One of the interesting things is that there still will be 256 players drafted this year, right? We're not going to reduce the number of draft picks he's gotten back to school to. Now, I will say that it does create some more fascinating, you know, draft economics discussions of what happens when the draft class is considered weaker, right? And when we say weaker, it should be framed this way, that there are fewer guys this year that teams are very confident will be on a roster in 3 years, right? Okay. So there's still a lot of good players out there, but teams are less, think about it in terms of risk than about talent. I think it makes more sense. So this year, I would say, you know, if I had to put together every team's board with their confidence level, probably about 140, 150 guys teams feel confident can play in the NFL for a couple of years. That number is usually 180, 190, 200. So that's going to lead to that's a whole different podcast about what happens late in the draft. Do guys that are better athletes go earlier, special teams guys, the kickoff rule, how's that played a role? But fascinating discussion there too. But I think NIL is great in that sense. You know, I always look back. I used to do a lot of underclassmen consulting back 7-8 years ago when the NFL advisor committee wasn't doing a great job. And I had my awakening about why this is so important for players, because I had a player who was, I won't name the player, but he was a late round PFA and he consulted for us. And me, in my, you know, being naive, I was like, why would you come out for the draft? And he's like, well, my mom is diagnosed with cancer. My brother has cerebral palsy. And if I can just make a practice squad for a year or two, I can help pay their bills.
Wow.
And for me, that was eye opening. And that's why NIL is great, because a player like him can just grad transfer to Bama and, you know, make $500,000 a backup, and he's great. And that's great news. I do think that there are probably too many colleges using NIL and plus misinformation about where a player might get drafted to have a guy stay in school and then be an older injury, all those different things. And that's hopefully something that gets cleaned up in the next couple of years as players get more information. But again, I'm big on player information. If players know the good information, they'll make a good decision too. I think NIL has made my job tougher, but who cares about me? It's better for the industry and it's better for these players to have more opportunities and more access.
You touched on it. You brought it up, and I certainly wanted to go there. The XFL, now NFL kickoff.
Crazy.
Obviously, you know, we knew this was coming to the NFL, if not this year, maybe next year. I know that they kind of kicked it around in 23 and then didn't end up doing it or whatever. Yeah. You know, everybody knows the kickoff is just broken. Like, we had to fix it. But that press release goes out a couple weeks ago, whenever it goes out. What does that feel like for you? Just what does it feel like?
2018, me, Sam Schwartzstein, Brian Kilmeade, Doug Whaley, Justin King are in some small JUCO Mississippi college testing out what a kickoff would look like. Where do we line up? What are the refs doing? And to think that 5-6 years later, that this would be what the NFL is using is so cool. And again, a lot of credit to Sam Schwartzstein, who is the brainchild of this now at Amazon Prime. It was really his innovative idea to make this play a play in a game and not just be a lost play. It's very cool to think about that. I got tipped off summer of last year that it might be coming the next year. And I'll be honest, I didn't believe it. And if I believed it, I would have been out front and had it in the 2024 Shrine Bowl. Because I would love to do it. You know, I told League Office my first job, hey, I will try the rules out you guys want to test, but I want to do XFL kickoff. And when I was at the Shrine Bowl, we had one of our head coaches, was Richard Hightower, who's a special teams coach for the Bears, who actually was one of the four special teams coaches who kind of spearheaded this in the NFL. I talked to him then and at the NFL Combine, and I was so thankful that he, among other ones, not only liked the idea to bring back the kickoff and the benefits for certainly special teams coaches to have more plays that they're under their purview, but how thoughtful they were and how next level they were on strategies. We'll see some really cool strategies that even our coach in the XFL, our year one, didn't have. Like, they weren't really thoughtful about it until, you know, in season. These coaches have already thought about it. They've already gamed out how, and that's why their rules are a little bit different than ours, because they've already gone in the rabbit hole of gaming things out. So I think there'll be an adjustment from a player standpoint in the NFL this year and even next year for upcoming rookies. Because keep in mind, a lot of special teams players are rookies or second year players in the NFL a lot of times. There'll be an adjustment from a player standpoint, but from a coaching standpoint, it was really empowering that this idea that Sam had, that we had tested for, you know, 2 years before putting into action, the people who are kind of now taking ownership of it are going to take good care of it. And that was really exciting for us to kind of see that special teams in the NFL is going to be a big part of what the XFL did back then.
What does testing
for
a literal brand new football play that I don't, had anybody ever run it?
Radically. No.
How do you test a brand new play from scratch? It's not even like you're adapting something, like you came up with it from zero.
Yeah. And I think data was a big part of it, right? We looked at data such as where are the kickoffs when they happen traditionally starting from a catch point, where is the contact happening on this play, right? How do we, and then lastly, how do we create rules from having teams circumvent the kickoff to going out of bounds or in the end zone, right? And that's what happened in the NFL's current rule, is that they just made the out of bounds kick out of the end zone the obvious answer. So playing with those yardage numbers, hey, what's the EPA on a drive that starts from the 30-yard line, the 35-yard line, the 45-yard line, right? Does that really punish them enough to not do this? Okay, so there was a lot of analytics based there. And then the data coming from where are the catch points from the returner happening? What are their average yards per play? Where is it? So a lot of data started it. But then for us testing it, you know, it was a little harder not having NFL guys to test it out with, people that are freshmen, sophomores. So JUCO was tough and challenging. Hey, I was back there returning kicks once in a while, and I was a third string high school quarterback, right? But for us, it was, hey, when this guy catches, what's he seeing? You know, what kind of scheme can you do? And then how do you defend against that scheme? And then referees involving Dean Blandino at the time too. Hey, how does this play going to be refereed? You know, for example, when the returner catches the ball, a ref will signal the ball has been caught. Like, that took 3 months to figure out how to do that. And that, will that work? Where's the referee's line of sight? If he does there, where's he going next? And it took a lot of time to figure out the mechanics. And I think another thing that I think Sam and our team is really proud of is the NFL is going to implement this radical rule change. Think about the overtime rule change they made too. What'd they do? They put it in preseason for a year or two.
Sure.
They are just saying, XFL, we're in. Now it's ours. Day one, week one, in the Super Bowl of this year, we'll have XFL kickoff. And that's really, that shows that the testing we put in and the time we spent building it, I think it showed that we can, this works, and this works right away.
How quickly will we see this on Saturdays?
I think it'll be a little bit of time, partially because college football is so disjointed that I don't think you, because you need universal buy-in, right? You're going to have out of conference games, and what are you going to do? Have the Big Ten teams do XFL kickoff and then the SEC teams do regular kickoff? Like, so I think the disjointed nature of college football is part of it. Until we have the super conference, that'll make it a little bit easier, but I think it'll take time. It wouldn't shock me if this happens in like the D2 level faster than the FBS level, right? I think that'd be.
Does it need to come to college football? It needed to come to the NFL. I think we can both agree.
No, it need to come to anything. College? Yeah, doesn't need to. I mean, I think one of the benefits of college football, right, is the kickers aren't as consistently big-legged, right? So there's more kickoffs just by nature of that. So I don't think it needs to. I think you should ask the question. I think you should never follow the leader. That's my personal philosophy, right? Ask why. Why does it make sense? And we'll do it our way, too. I think it would certainly help the college to pro transition, but, you know, that's a sixth, the seventh of all players in college football every year. So I think it's a good question. Selfishly, they should do it 100%, right? But I think it's a good question to ask if it's worthwhile to do. But my guess would be it gets adopted fairly quickly in college ranks is 3 to 5 years. So maybe faster, but it won't be next year in college football. That's for sure. I'd be surprised if it was, I guess.
What is this going to do to the draft process and how some types of college football players are scouted? And I think the first place there, you actually had a really insightful Twitter thread on this. What is this going to do to players 45 through 53 on an NFL roster?
Yeah, I think it's going to do so much. And I think it may take a year or even two for even NFL decision makers to really comprehend the difference here. Right. Because it's really probably by the first training camp, we'll see. And by the first couple weeks of the season, we'll see a big delta of which teams took this seriously and which teams just said, hey, we'll figure it out. Because it does take a real, it does take a really a different. So for example, right, the last couple of years, we talk about special teams aces, right, in the draft process. I mean, a special teams ace. You were really saying either he's a returner or he's a gunner on punt team. That was it. That's all you really meant by that, right? Because kickoffs didn't matter. Return, who cares about return blocking, right? It was just all about gunners. And I think that's now changed drastically. Now you have 8, 9, 10 plays a game that are kickoff, kickoff, return that weren't in the game a year ago. And that matters quite a bit too. For kickoff return, the style of player matters, right? Gunners a little bit will help, but you kind of want linebackers and safeties who can stack and shed on defense on the kickoff team. And then return team, you kind of want those stretch blockers at tight end, at fullback, and maybe some bigger wide receivers. So you'll need, long story short, I think we'll see more teams carry an extra tight end. Or lean that way, at least more linebackers and safeties. Maybe a fullback running back who can do this and is okay with it as a run blocker. And maybe that leads to less D line, right? Teams have carried 8, 9, 10 offensive linemen in the last couple of years, in part because they could. But now maybe don't have that luxury anymore. And maybe offensive line depth is a little bit harder to find in the NFL because you need to carry more linebackers for kickoff because those guys can't play on that. So I think there'll be a lot of, and then the other piece too is the returners, right? Returners in the past, it was, put a really fast guy back there who could make, you know, have some vision and then burst up field. Now you kind of want a running back or a Deebo Samuel-like receiver. Cordarrelle Patterson, I think, is the template for what teams want now of a guy who has vision, who can do a one-cut zone blocking scheme or maybe a man blocking scheme too. So it's it'll be very impactful, I think, this year in the NFL because we'll see which teams really were thoughtful about in the draft process and roster building, which teams weren't. And I think we'll see in the next 2-3 years a radical change in roster construction because of this rule, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I like, you know, we talked about it on the show a couple weeks ago, and I'm harping, like, this is a massive deal. It's not tongue in cheek when I say this is going to change the sport. Like, it may be in some edgewise ways you don't realize, but like, let's say scoring goes up. Let's say some unintended consequences that may be good, maybe bad. Let's say scoring jacks up next year. And you're like, wait, what the hell happened? Well, they're starting every drive on the 40 because Nobody knows how to defend this kick return. And, these returners are getting out to the 40 and the 45, maybe even midfield. And you're just starting, you know, drives are shorter, all this kind of stuff. There are so many knock-on effects to this that because we haven't seen this done with, no disrespect, the best athletes in the world, like, we don't know really what the top end of this play is going to do to the sport. And that's why I am fascinated by it. I'm fascinated with potential implementation in college, and I'm fascinated by what we're going to see on Sundays in the fall.
I think the first half of the NFL season, it wouldn't shock me if there was a 15-yard delta in average starting position, right? For the teams that were like pragmatic and thought about this, and for both kickoff return and kickoff, I think there could be a very big delta the first 6-7 weeks of the season because I think teams are really smart about this. If you have a really good scheme as a kickoff team, you can stop them at the 15-20-yard line, right? And if you have a good kickoff return, you could be at the 40-yard line, like you said, too. Like, it could be a pretty big delta between the teams that took it seriously and the teams that didn't do. And that's going to have a huge impact on wins in the NFL, on yards, on all that stuff. And I think it's going to be really fascinating to see early on.
Like, and you know, you get galaxy brain about it. Yards become points become wins become jobs. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, goodness gracious. Galco, I am really glad that we got to do this. Thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate the time and I appreciate the candor and I appreciate the conversation, my friend.
Always, man. Appreciate having me on.
And Lord, let us please hope that the Jacksonville Jaguars take the XFL kickoff seriously in their offseason planning. That's all I'll say.